Lunchtime Lecture Summer School 2013. I'm Janet Small from the Summer School Office, and I'm here to introduce Permanent Persuader, Govan Mbeki, and the Place of Ideas in the National Liberation Struggle. We're very privileged to have with us Professor Colin Bundy to talk about Govan Mbeki and his life as an activist and an intellectual in the ANC. As I said to the professor at the beginning, it's very hard to do justice to his career, and I don't think I'm even going to try, but here are some highlights. He has an illustrious record in both South Africa and the United Kingdom, where he's been highly influential in both historiography and in a leadership role in higher education and in administration, both in the UK and South Africa. He's recently retired from a post of principal of Green Templeton College at the University of Oxford, where he oversaw the merge of two Oxford colleges to launch the newest graduate college. He also served as Vice Chancellor of Wits University and as Principal of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. In the 1990s, he was Vice Rector at UWC down the road here. And as a scholar and intellectual, Colin Bundy is renowned for his contributions to substantially reinterpreting South African history. He's well known for his work, The Rise and Fall of the South African Peasantry, and has written extensively on South African history and politics. Most recently, this book, which you may have seen, it's on sale at the bookshops here, which is on Govan Mbeki, very appropriately for the lecture today. And he's also had a very active role in public service in South Africa and the UK. I'm not going to list the details because I'd like to get onto the topic, so I'll hand you over to Prof. Bundy.
Janet, thank you so much. I would like to begin in 1941 in a shabby, small general trading store in the district of Idutswa in the Transkei. This little general store sold groceries, blankets, bags of grain, kitchenware, candles, paraffin, and beads. It stood in the straggling village of Mbeuleni, and in 1941 the store had been open for less than a year. Inside, its walls and counters were stained red, brushed countless times by the ochre-dipped clothing of its customers. At that point, only a few dozen of the 700 stores in the Transkei were owned by Africans. The Mbeuleni store was more singular yet. It had been launched as a cooperative store. It was the first of its kind in the Transkei, and one of very few in South Africa, a co-op owned by a group of members. And I chose 1941 to begin because two visitors to the store wrote down their impressions. The first was admiring. The man behind the counter has much work, wrapping, weighing, cutting, measuring, selling, persuading, and last but not least, talking to the people. His is a strenuous job. He must speak to the people about their lowly location affairs in a friendly spirit, encourage them in their undertakings, and yet sometimes he's even asked to give a review of the international situation. It's the World War, unquote. The second visitor, a couple of months later, was skeptical. What is most pathetic about this store is its being most scantily furnished. Shelves are almost bare. Surely this sort of thing cannot carry anybody very far. Surprisingly enough, the man behind the counter is doubly degreed. To my mind, it is either that he has the patience of an ass or the courage of a lion. How on earth does he ever hope to sustain and maintain his growing family? The shopkeeper was Govan Mbeki. From 1940 to 1951, Mbeuleni was his home, the shop his livelihood, and an unlikely base for a left-wing intellectual and activist. Govan Mbeki, as this audience will know, was a political activist, a writer, a long-term political prisoner, and father of President Thabo Mbeki. He, Govan, was born in July 1910. The Union of South Africa was 6 weeks old. His parents were members of a relatively well-to-do Transkei elite. They were literate, they were schooled, they were devout Methodists, and they were modernizers. They built the first stone house in Idutra district. They prioritized education for their children. All eight of their children entered secondary schools, and the Lart Lameki, the last born governor, went even further. By the time he left Fort Hare in 1937, with a BA and a teaching diploma, at which point he promptly enrolled for a degree in economics with UNISA, that's the doubly degreed that the man mentioned. At this point, Garvin leaving Fort Hare was an intellectual in the making. He has already embarked on his lifelong love of romantic poetry, the English romantics. He also was a Latin scholar. He spent his last couple of terms at Fort Hare translating the verse of Catullus into prose. He was brimming with ideas about literature, nationalism, and socialism. His 5 years at Fort Hare equipped him with the formal skills, if you like, the literary skills and intellectual skills, that fueled his output as a journalist and author. But there were 5 years that also politicized him. He joined the ANC in 1935, and he was also close to the Communist Party from the end of the 1930s. These twin strands of his politics, African nationalism and socialism, remained consistent, although their balance shifted over time. Jump well ahead, Mbeki's unexpected release from Robben Island, November 1987, was a dry run for Mandela's release. In the final decade of his life, he held largely ceremonial political office, as Deputy President of the Senate, and he continued to write, authoring two slim volumes in the twilight of his life. He died in 2001. I have referred to Govan Mbeki as an intellectual, and I want to explore that term more formally. Because firstly, there's a direct link between the politics of nationalism and the role of an educated elite or intellectuals. Nationalism, that is, politics organized around the idea of a nation state, folk, context is one of the great modernizing forces, one of the great mobilizing forces of modernity. And in the scholarship on nationalism, whether it's in Europe, in Asia, Africa, or the Middle East, there is virtual unanimity about the active role of the intelligentsia, especially in the early stages of nationalist politics. Everywhere, nationalism travels on predictable lines. It is strongest wherever schooling is most firmly established, where newly educated strata stoke and drive the nationalist engine. Scholarship on African nationalism in this continent during the colonial era tells the same story. An overview concludes, and I'm quoting, the main carriers of nationalist ideologies are its intelligentsia, unquote. A British scholar called Tom Mann has emphasized that educated elites could only mobilize their societies by winning support amongst the more numerous masses. And in a memorable phrase, he wrote that the new middle-class intelligentsia had to invite the masses into history, and the invitation card had to be written in a language that they understood. Nan is using language metaphorically, but the question of what language is available to nationalists is crucial to the work of Benedict Anderson, author of, I believe, the most influential single work on nationalism written in the last 30 years, a book called Imagined Communities. And this is a long quote from Benedict Anderson. It is generally recognized that the intelligentsia was central to the rise of nationalism in colonial territories, and also that the intelligentsia's vanguard role derived from its bilingual literacy. Members of the emerging nationalist intelligentsia were almost invariably young, and they attached a complex political significance to their youth. Youth meant, above all, the first generation in any significant numbers to have acquired a European education, marking them off linguistically and culturally from their parents. In the colonies, then, by youth, we mean school youth, at least at the start. Now, that paragraph suggests to me so much about the network of mission schools in the Eastern Cape, the role of Fort Hare, the emergence of the African National Congress Youth League in the 1940s, that it scarcely requires further comment. It's an absolutely accurate illustration of what Anderson's talking about. But I'm going to dwell on a less obvious issue, his notion of bilingual literacy. Bilingualism for the young intellectual is not only a question of formal competence in two languages. It's also about the ability to operate in two cultural spheres. It's a bilingualism that derives from exposure to both high and folk cultures and being able to mediate between them. It means being able to express the virtues or vices of one culture in terms that the other would apprehend. Now, for all the historians that I've quoted so far, intellectuals is used in the conventional sense, I guess the way we would most of the time, in the sense of well-educated people, teachers, clergymen, journalists, the isifundiswa, people, learned people, defined by the jobs they do. But I want to introduce now a rather different way of thinking about intellectuals, and it's been very, very influential in a lot of scholarly work. And this is an idea first developed by Antonio Gramsci, writing in the 1920s and 30s. Gramsci defined intellectuals not by how learned they are, nor by what professions they follow, but by virtue of their social function. That is, how their knowledge affects society. Intellectuals, Gramsci insisted, are not a separate class, nor do they exist as a social category free from or above, separate from class. Instead, he said, as any society's major classes develop, these classes generate corresponding types of intellectuals. Every class, wrote Gramsci, creates together with itself, organically, one or more strata of intellectuals. So what is it that these organic intellectuals do? Their role is essentially to organize and give direction to the thinking of a particular class or oppressed group. Every class, here particularly for Gramsci, he's talking about subordinate classes, peasants, or working class and the like. Every subordinate group will have its own ideas and beliefs, evidently. But these tend to be rough-hewn, unsophisticated. For Gramsci, the task of transforming these rough and jagged ideas into coherent, powerful, and plausible thought, his words, is the task that falls to intellectuals. It is intellectuals, he wrote, who transform the incoherent and fragmentary feelings of those who live in a particular class position into a coherent and reasoned account of the world as it appears from that position. taking feelings, translating them into ideas, into a coherent set of ideas. The mass of people, said Gramsci, whether they're workers or peasants, the mass of people does not become independent in its own right without, in the widest sense, organizing itself. And there is no organization without intellectuals. That is, without organizers and leaders. So far, so straightforward. But the link, the traffic, if you like, between intellectuals and the masses flows both ways. It's a dialectical relationship. Gramsci described the link in these words. The popular element, that's the working class or the peasantry or the poor, the popular element feels, but does not always know or understand. The intellectual element knows, but does not always understand, and in particular does not always feel. The organic intellectual cannot know without feeling. He or she has to know, has to feel, to experience the feelings of the masses in order properly to know. Only by feeling the elementary passions of the people can intellectuals explain and justify them. That's the end of the theoretical bit. But in thinking about Govan Mbeki's life, I found the concept of organic intellectual a very fruitful one. And so I've borrowed the title of today's lecture from Gramsci. From this sentence, the mode of being of the new intellectual, the organic intellectual, can no longer consist in eloquence, but in active participation in practical life. As constructor, organizer, permanent persuader, and not just a simple orator. Unquote. So thus armed, let me return to the Transkei in the early 1940s. To observe something of Govan Mbeki's participation in practical life during that decade. Govan had taught in Durban for a couple of years after Fort Hur, where he courted and later married a fellow teacher, Epainette Mairani, Piney Mbeki, she became. It was also while in Durban that Govan Mbeki wrote a short book called Transkei in the Making, a book that identified issues to which he would return again and again. The economic difficulties confronting African peasants, the political economy of the reserves, a critique of chiefs and headmen. In the Bunga's cozy chairs at Mtata, they represent nobody but themselves, he wrote in 1937. And the importance of education. The Transkei, he wrote, boasted a number of Fort Hare graduates. But where are they? I'm quoting, where are they? What is the purpose of educating these young fellows if, after the completion of their studies, they are not to come to the territories and apply the knowledge which they have acquired? And Govan answered this question for himself by moving back to the Transkei from Durban. Initially as a teacher at Clarkbury, the mission school, and when he was dismissed from that post, he opened the trading store near Iducha. He also learned a little editing in Kuntla Yabantu, the only newspaper at that time entirely owned and operated by Africans. And he produced a stream of editorials and articles for that paper until 1943. He tried unsuccessfully to get the ANC to take over in Kuntla as its own newspaper. And he wasn't successful, but he also used its pages to advance African nationalist sentiments. He stressed the African ownership of Nkuntla and its commitment to African interests. Quote, our duty has always been, ever is, and shall always be to the African people first. Nothing, he wrote, can make us for a moment forget our main purpose, the struggle for national liberation. And then 2 years later, in 1943, Mbeki mounted, sorry, 1942, Mbeki in the pages of Nkundla mounted an ambitious and classically nationalist project. He announced that Nkundla would create a gallery of African heroes. Short biographies with pictures of African men and women who had advanced the African cause. Each biography would be illustrated and, quote, should be of incredible help to the school teacher. A successful series would certainly be the African people's history in the making, unquote. It's 1942. And then he wrote the first of these portraits, about three quarters of a page in text and picture. And it was a biography of Hintsa, the Xhosa king. He used existing historical accounts, Macmillan's Bounty Boer in Britain, Thiel, etc. But he also drew on S.E.K. McQuay's epic verse, the oral poet living at that time, as a source. The biography of Hintsa is heroic, moving, and didactic. It's a vivid instance of history harnessed for nationalist purposes. And I'm going to quote, this is Govan Mbeki writing on Hintsa. The making of big historical events is usually not confined to one locality. Hintsa, a contemporary of Napoleon, belonged to the big trio of African kings, Moshesh, Chaka, and Hintsa. Hintsa lived and ruled at a time when Britain was feverishly forging her empire with iron and fire. Times were generally unhappy, and Sikana, the great prophet, had prophesied such times, and in truth they came. The poet laureate, Imbonga Yeziswa, had declared, like Bismarck, the world is sick. Iswa liyasusa. Mbeki then argued that what we may today call Hintsa's administration was founded on natural democratic principles. And he illustrates this by the details. He works through a court case heard before Hintsa, emphasizing the public nature of the hearing and the active role of the people in the process. Hintsa, abiding by majority decision, I'm quoting, showed himself to be guardian of the people's traditions and their democratic institutions, unquote. Mbeki then goes on to narrate how Hintsa was taken hostage, how he refused to work for the British against other Xhosa chiefs, how he made a dash for freedom, was shot dead, and his body mutilated. Quote, Hintsa died free, that his people might have freedom and have it more abundantly. As in so often, you get these New Testament echoes in Govan's prose. Now, I quoted Benedict Anderson earlier on that notion of the bilingualism, the cultural bilingualism of the nationalist intellectual. Somebody who's exposed to both folk and high culture and draws on both. And I think this article in Hintsa is a wonderful example of it. Born at the time of Napoleon, Bismarck said, but also Mkwai, Sikana, and the rest. This is Mbeki, editor, as a traditional intellectual, deploying his learning and his rhetorical skills. But what about Mbeki as an organic intellectual in the way that I defined it a moment ago? How did Mbeki and the Transkei translate his youthful idealism and his intellectual energies into politics? I've described the years in the Transkei in this little book, and today I'm only going to make the briefest of summaries. Mbeki knew very well that the ANC had only a tenuous presence in the Transkei. As he put it in a letter to the Secretary General, the Transkei is, to be frank, politically in midnight slumber. For a decade, Govan tried to break that slumber, to prod the Transkei awake. He He never succeeded in persuading Dr. Truma and the urban leadership of the ANC to make rural mobilization a priority. But it remained his priority. He started work initially in the relatively elitist structure, the TAVA, Transkei African Voters Association. This is before 1948 and Africans could still vote in the Cape. And the TAVA had branches in every district in the Transkei. By 1941, he'd been elected secretary of the TAVA, and that became the base from which he built a much more substantial organized presence in the Transkei territories. The TAVA issued a call for a conference of, quote, all organized bodies in the Transkei to decide on priorities and to present their demands, unquote, to government. And early in 1943, over 100 delegates launched the TOB, the Transkei Organized Bodies. Cutting across tradition, noted Nkundla, women delegates were on equal footing with men. Delegates came from farmers' organizations, cooperative societies, vigilance associations, welfare societies, a trade union, a social studies club, and two women's organizations. The TOB took these disparate elements and wove them into a single source of pressure. So it created a pressure block out of them. And over the next few years, its program, its annual resolutions, and its actions took on a distinctively more radical line. Govan involved the TOB in a national campaign against the Pass Force. He wrote articles and made speeches denouncing the Pass Force. He was elected to represent the Eastern Cape on the National Anti-Pass Council. Over and over again, he called in the Transkei for new levels of commitment. They were heady days. In October 1943, Mbeki told an interviewer, quote, that the pulse of the Transkei is quickening encouragingly, and that he sought to organize the region's voters, into a solid block of loyal and politically conscious members. Local politics, he said, fed into broader forms. Quote, people must be interested in more immediate issues and thus gradually link them up with the national struggle. Start with local issues, build a core of loyal and politically conscious members, and gradually link them up with the national struggle. This was the essence of Govan Mbeki's strategy then and in the rest of his politically active life. In 1947, Mbeki led the TOB into another national ANC campaign. This was a boycott of all parliamentary and native representative council elections. And there was to be a by-election in the Transkei for a parliamentary seat. And so Govan committed himself to the boycott campaign. We were throwing everything into the fire, he wrote. The Transkei is up and doing. Don't let us down. He wrote privately to Dr. Tuma, the ANC president. Our fears here are that we might work up the people, only to find that the rest of the country does not attach much significance to its resolutions. Country folk have a way of being honest. And his fears were realized. The ANC leadership wavered, changed tack, and then simply abandoned the boycott. The Volksfront impacted on the Transkei unsurprisingly and precipitated a contest for control of the TOB. Govan lost that contest. He was voted out as secretary of the TOB, and by the year's end, the TOB had affiliated to a rival organization, the All Africa Convention, under the fiery leadership of I.B. Tabata. Boycott was the AAC's chief tactic, and so it could claim a consistency that the ANC had forfeited. loss of his base in the TOB was a major setback. But it shouldn't lead one to overlook what Mbeki had achieved in years of sustained intellectual and political activism. His role in radicalizing Transkei politics was a palpable one, a considerable organizational success on scant resources. The TOB enlarged the scale of rural opposition to the state, and the popular militancy shown in the anti-pass and the boycott campaigns deserved far greater support from the ANC leadership than it received. And so these years, the 1940s, were Govan's political apprenticeship. His subsequent reputation, this is Ruth First writing, that he was an ANC kingpin in the Eastern Cape, organizer, propagandist, technician, policymaker, man of action, and intellectual, unquote, was well earned. But his role in Port Elizabeth a few years later simply cannot be understood without prior appreciation of his efforts to rouse the Transkei. Paraphrasing Wordsworth, Govan wrote to Tuma in 1946, "What a joy it is to be alive these days when history is being made all around us." Think again of Gramsci's organic intellectual, providing organization, shaping and directing popular thinking and popular beliefs. This is essentially the task that Govan set himself. His political project, build a local body of loyal, politically conscious members and then link them with the national struggle, is strategically, he never read Gramsci, but it's strategically in accordance with that proposed by the Sardinian, by Gramsci. I'm quoting from him, "Work incessantly to raise the intellectual level of ever-growing strata of the populace. Produce intellectuals of a new type, which rise directly out of the masses, but remain in contact with them, to become, as it were, the whalebone in the corset." Only older members of our audience will fully appreciate that metaphor. What Gramsci's really saying is that speaking to the people, speaking for the people, means listening to people. And one way in which Govan was in contact with ideas from below was the trading store. He not only sold goods to his customers, and his customers were predominantly illiterate, red-blanketed, Amatlaba people, but he mixed with. I like the glimpse of him singing and practicing traditional dances with his neighbors outside the shop. He wrote letters for them. He advised them. In 1947 in Kutlayabantu noted, this is after he's editing it, "The Transkei progressives have made a definite bid to win the support of this section of the population. They go into the homes and huts of the people. They sleep and eat and chat together with them, and condition their mode of thinking in this intimate way." Listening and speaking. Ruth First wrote later that while Govan used official statistics and sources and blue books when he wrote, quote, "The commoners of the Transkei remained his chief source of information, and as he loved them, so they trusted and confided in him." I interviewed Piney Mbeki, Mrs. Mbeki, about the Idutshwa years. She's a formidable 94-year-old today, wonderful woman. And I asked her whether Govan became caught up with local politics. And she replied, "Some people who come here, they bring their small problems. They bring their small problems." It was the same with him. Sometimes somebody wants to start a business, or somebody wants to go to these industrial areas and seek for work, doesn't know what steps to take. You know, such problems. Somebody gets injured in Johannesburg and they don't know where to go for compensation. Such like. And somebody's cattle will get ill. They don't know what to do. what medicine to use, all sorts of problems. When I heard it, it played like an echo almost of that vignette 50 years after it was written, when I interviewed her, 50 years after that vignette that I started with, of Mbeki wrapping, weighing, cutting, measuring, selling, persuading, and last but not least, speaking to the people. What did Gramsci say? The role of an organic intellectual comprises active participation in practical life as constructor, organizer, permanent persuader. But I'm going to move with Govan from the rural Transkei to urban Port Elizabeth and glance more briefly at another period of his life. He left the Transkei in the early 50s, sojourned for a couple of years in Ladysmith, Natal, and in mid-1955 he moved to the port city to run the office of the New Age newspaper. He lived and worked in PE until 1962, when he went underground, moved to the Transvaal, and was finally arrested at Lily's Leaf Farm in Rivonia in July 1963. In Port Elizabeth, journalism was his day job, and Govan wrote prolifically in these years, but he was also a tireless activist. The township of New Brighton was already, by some measure, the most militant ANC base in the country. The history there of left-wing trade unionism and of community protests had meshed in 1952 to see the Defiance campaign markedly more successful and more significant in Port Elizabeth than anywhere else in the country. And Govan's distinctive contribution to mobilization in Port Elizabeth was an educational one. He explained his project in matter-of-fact terms. I arrived in Port Elizabeth, where they had built a core during the Defiance campaign of what was known as the Volunteers. This was a group of ordinary men and women, virtually all of them from the working class. I came in as a teacher, and my view was to draw from my experience as a teacher. How do you educate? I felt we needed to bring into the ANC those methods, educational methods. And that key contribution was not just an educative one, but was political educational. Govan made an early decision. The Communist Party had been running study groups in Port Elizabeth since the early 1940s. But the ANC had no equivalent. Again, I'm quoting from an interview. So I said, no, we should go further than that. The people who are going to bear the brunt of the struggle are members of the ANC. It is they who must understand why they are in the struggle. And Mbeki then launched a program of political education without equal in any South African city in the 1950s. He wrote, he cyclostyled, and he distributed a booklet of about 50 pages, outlining the history, aims, and policies of the movement. Govan insisted that it must be written in Xhosa, accessible to a grassroots leadership. Others in the Communist Party were skeptical. Govan told me, and I'm quoting, they say, how can you talk Marxism in Xhosa? And my answer always was, surely the Chinese, which have got the biggest Communist Party in the world, they don't teach in English. The booklet was used by study groups. He borrowed something he'd seen in Sunday schools. You know, when you read Matthew 1 to Matthew 23, or whatever it is, you have the text for that week. He did the same thing. So many pages this week, this topic that week, so that all of the study groups were working on the same material. So if somebody moved, you know, from one street to another, it would still be at the right place in the book. And the booklet was used in these study groups, meeting in secret, in groups of 10. In March 1956, the government made it an offence for anyone to hold or address any gathering of 10 Africans or more in the districts of Port Elizabeth and Humanstock. Normal politics were proscribed. The solution was to operate below the radar, to take activism underground. From 56, we were compelled to duck, Goldman recalled. Now, it was during this time, 1956 to 60, that we perfected methods of working underground. And he reminisced about these activities. In fact, I think I'm happier with underground work. For so many years, we were doing underground work, and I became happy there. You work deep into the night, addressing, discussing problems in small groups in the townships. Often I used to leave work at 5 o'clock, I'd get back in the townships, have a cup of coffee, and then get buried in the townships in these small political classes. I'll be back home between 12 and 1 a.m., only then to have my supper. But it was rewarding work. It was rewarding work. Because from those small classes, we got people who became trained, and they would go out in turn to do what you are doing with them. If each group reached this level and taught 10 others, then you could, I'm quoting again from Goldman, then you quickly got to 100. It snowballed like that. At this time, Goldman also wrote dozens of leaflets for clandestine distribution across the township and also into rural areas in the Eastern Cape. A political leaflet, he said, was a great instrument for one working under conditions of illegality. It could be pushed through thousands of doors, and every home reads the leaflet, and they keep talking about it in every home. Unquote. He warmed to the theme. Leaflets were far better than speeches. As soon as people left a meeting or rally, the spoken word, I'm quoting again, the spoken word goes with the wind. A leaflet, a written word, goes into every home. And it would be talked about for a long time. It's exciting, underground work. It is very, very rewarding. Those are reminiscences 40 years after the events of the 1950s. Now, to move towards a conclusion, how does one sum up Goldman's contribution to ideas within the liberation struggle? Firstly, he was a writer. There's a leading online history site here in South Africa that says the Peasants' Revolt was a major historical study of peasant struggles, which it was not. And it concludes with a flourish, indeed he was one of the great Marxist writers of the previous century, which he was not. He was variously a pamphleteer, polemicist, and reporter. When he had time to devote himself to the task, he was a commentator, essayist, analyst, and book-length author. And Goldman viewed his exertions across this range of literary categories as seamless. In almost everything he wrote, the written word was deployed as part of a broader social and political project. Without any doubt, his most important writings were a sustained attempt to understand and reveal the political economy of the Transkei. For 35 years, Goldman wrote about the effects of migrant labor, about rural poverty, landlessness, and overstocking. He described the creation of a rural proletariat as a reserve army of labor. And he contrasted the bland language of rehabilitation or betterment with the grim social realities of the landless poor. He was one of the earliest critics of how chiefs and headmen had become complicit in apartheid rule. That analysis was constantly updated and sharpened and rethought and reworked in newspaper and journal articles through the 40s and 50s. And finally elaborated most fully in The Peasants' Revolt, published while he was in prison in 1963. The cumulative importance of this work is substantial. His writings on the Transkei are the most innovative and most durable of his output. Secondly, he was a teacher. Robert often referred to his training, his practice, and his identity as a teacher. He wrote a note to a younger prisoner on Robben Island, cheerfully confessing to his schoolmasterly ways. "You complain that my note was full of provocative assertions, hints, and undeveloped points, which have set your mind a-thinking. Blame my training as a teacher. One of the most important lessons was the injunction to draw the answers from the pupils. They should work out answers from the hints thrown out. When I write, I so often forget that my position is no longer that of a teacher." And he was talking, of course, about his writings on Robben Island, the extraordinary project of education, both formal education, getting people literate, getting people through JC, getting people through matric, getting people through university degrees, a formal program of education, and a parallel hidden program of political education. Some extraordinary essays written by Govan and others on Robben Island have survived, and there's a little book called Learning from Robben Island, The Prison Writings of Govan Beckel. His relish for the classroom was unmistakable. Here he is speaking about that educational program on the island. It's a longish quote. "You know, it was such a pleasure. We prepared a document, it gets circulated. At some stage you get a feedback. Somebody is posing questions. Somebody is not satisfied. And he would write back wanting a further explanation. It was thrilling. It was like being a teacher in the classroom. You know, you go into the classroom, you start a lesson, and they all sit there with blank faces. You start delivering the lesson, and one by one, it's like stars in the sky. You see one star come up, and one by one these faces brighten up all of a sudden. And you realize that what you're trying to put across is being appreciated, is being understood." Unquote. Teacher to his fingertips. But these professional identities as writer and teacher simply cannot be understood without reference to Govan's politics and his role as a revolutionary. He wrote and he taught because he believed in the force of ideas. And he wanted those ideas to change society for the better. To that project, Govan remained wedded right through his adult life. More than any other leader of the South African Liberation Movement, Mbeki attempted to link theory and practice, to reconcile intellect and activism. He worked for a quarter of a century before spending the same amount of time on Robben Island. But in the preceding quarter of a century, he worked to organize landless people, peasants, migrant workers, and urban workers. He did so by apprehending their hopes, fears, and desires, and then expressing these in theoretical and programmatic writing. All those days travelling through Transkei villages, all those evenings around kitchen tables in New Brighton, and then all the columns, the articles, the leaflets, it is these that establish Govan Mbeki as an organic intellectual. Thank you very much. Got 10 minutes, and if there are any questions or comments, I'd be most happy to take them. Yes.
Professor Bundy, I wonder if you would care to dilate on an issue which you raised briefly and then passed on, and that is the issue of language. On the one hand, the mother tongue, and on the other hand, the pervasive cultural and political influence of
English. I was making the case that sort of bilingualism and the schooling that produced it was extremely important for, speaking historically, for an elite, an educated elite at the time. And I also tried to indicate that South Africa is absolutely no different from other societies, whether in South Asia, Latin America, elsewhere in Africa, in having that combination of modernizing forces, education, literacy, bilingualism, modernizing nationalism, the idea of a nation, again, a modernizing, mobilizing force. And the point about them in my lecture this evening is how they brought together in certain circumstances and brought together in South Africa by Govan's generation and the one that immediately followed his, particularly. After that, education broadens out, becomes more broad-based. It's not quite such an elite that is both the recipient of the best education and the transmitter of those ideas. Certainly by the, there's a talk here tomorrow about Steve Biko, his ideas and his generation. By that time, the experiences of high school are more generalized. Behind you.
Sorry,
I'll
take a point.
Yeah, he was dismissed four times altogether, once in Durban, once in Clarkbury, and twice in Ladysmith. And on each occasion, it was for politics, for being too political. The first two instances, he was dismissed by the school authorities, the last two times by central government. He was very indignant about this. Just let me find a quote very, very quickly. He was indignant about those dismissals. He said, "I adopted an attitude where I gave everything as a teacher inside the classroom, as a Latin master, physical science teacher, psychology of education, principles of education, plus teaching course of physiology and hygiene. I gave everything that I had in the classroom so that I should not be blamed for not paying attention to my work as a teacher on the grounds that I was spending too much time preaching politics outside the classroom. I never had a single failure in all the subjects I have mentioned, both at high school and at the training school. In the few years as a teacher, I never had a failure in my class. Thank you. I wanted to add that." So,
yes. You mentioned earlier on that he considered the chiefs in the Bunga to represent nobody but themselves. Yes. Now, that's not the case, is it? Because there's a tremendous loyalty. They were wrong politically. They were paid hirelings of the government in the Bunga. And there were among them chiefs like Victor Porto, Mr. Ponderdam, who were moving towards the sort of ideas that Govan Mbeki had. Did he have any such connections, or did he think that tribalism, to use a politically incorrect term, that tribalism was out and you didn't deal with it?
I think that his position would have been closer to that. It would have been a disinclination to work with customary or traditional leaders because he felt that those customary and traditional positions had been so compromised by their involvement, you know, with apartheid, specifically with the Bantustans once Kadi Mthunzima was in charge. And it was, it became a very hard line position of his, and was the issue that triggered a fallout amongst the top leadership of the ANC on Robben Island.
Of course, just to add a quick point, that after his activity in the Transkei, the Temboland chief, Tabata Danindyebo, he could so easily have worked with a man like that, and other men, of course, it tended to happen as a chief became prominent in that, he got rid of.
And I think Sabata Danindyebo, the comrade chief, went to Lusaka. I think his position is a bit different. Govan was capable of working specifically, I'm now referring to Ponderland, the Ponder Revolt in 1960, working with quite often people on one side of a headmanship dispute, and if you like, favouring their candidates. But that was pragmatic politics, not anything else.
How do you think would have responded to President Zuma's, "We mustn't make them too clever"?
Yes. the Goblin Mbeki that I knew and interviewed and became very fond of and whom I admired very intensely, I think would have been very discomforted by a number of features of the present moment. I don't just want to say President Zuma. I think we were just talking about custom and tradition. He would have had given very short shrift to the new bill giving greater judicial authority to chiefs. He would have been quite caustic about defending cronyism by reference to custom and tradition. He would have had short shrift. I've got two more.
I think Valencia has continued that tradition or that line of thinking. But my question is, when and how did he connect with Nelson Mandela and
Okay, I'll repeat the question. And I'm going to take one other two. That question was reference to Malezi and Becky, his son, continuing to look like governs politics in some ways, but the question was how and when did Govan Mbeki first connect with Mandela and Oliver Tambo? Take this other question as well.
I put it on a more general note. I'm intrigued by the fact that many of these leaders, Mandela, Sobukwe, Biko, Mbeki, they don't seem to have engaged with their children around issues of leadership and community and all of that. And I find a contrast between that and the more traditional chiefly leaders, where a child, for better or worse, would be identified and then groomed into that role. Is there any study on that? Is there any study on, obviously here I'm thinking about Gavin and Thabo, and in fact, even Mulezi, because Mulezi is not doing what Gavin was doing in the sense that you described, in the sense of being there in the community, organizing, teaching, any record of conversations with his kids and around some of these issues.
Okay. Govan met Nelson Mandela first time in the 1950s. They were not chance encounters, but they were brief encounters. Once when he went to Johannesburg, and twice when Mandela was traveling in the Eastern Cape. But that's really all that they were. I'm absolutely gone blank on this, but I cannot recall. Of course he met Tambo, and I tell in the book how on the day of Sharpeville, it was a phone call from Tambo to Mbeki in Durban, the New Age offices in Durban, that took him up to an emergency meeting of the ANC National Executive Committee, which by then would have been chaired by Tambo. His links with that leadership, that generation, were by far closest with Walter Sisulu. He met Walter at the whatever was it called, Bantu Men's Social Club, I think, in Johannesburg in 1937, or 36 he met him, and they became firm friends then, and right the way through after. It's a huge topic. I suppose it's been addressed most closely by Mark Gavissa in his biography of Thabo, where the absence of fathers is a theme. Thabo as a child with an absent father, and then Thabo's son with him as an absent father. So, and I've not gone there in this little book because Mark wrote so fully and I thought so sensitively about the family relations and the babies. But I think you are right. I think there is a larger point about family dynamics in these nationalist households. And I suspect that one should also be talking about gender. Robbins was an uncomplicatedly old-fashioned masculinist response. I asked him, and I can't quote it here because I haven't got the text, but I asked him, did he have any hand in bringing up his own sons and daughter? And I got a very defensive and quite a poignant answer. He would say things like, I would help them with their schoolwork sometimes, otherwise I might ruffle their hair. And the kind of limits of that, I thought, spoke volumes. But I'm speaking there just for that case. I suspect there is a fascinating larger study. You'll have to go away and rewrite your lecture for tomorrow on Steve Biko. With that, can I thank you all very, very much.